Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Boy, that IRS story has staying power, doesn't it?
Today, Secretary Liu took the first step by requesting and accepting the resignation of the acting commissioner of the IRS. Because given the controversy surrounding this audit, it's important to institute new leadership that can help restore confidence going forward.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 15th of May. And yes, it's another day, another lead story about a scandal. And what do you suppose they do at the White House during weeks like these, when there are almost more scandals than you can count? The president took on one of them head-on this afternoon, the IRS going after conservative political groups that had applied to be tax-exempt organizations, 501c4s in the vernacular. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is online from Washington with the latest on this story. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, Kai.
So Stephen Miller has, in essence, been fired, right? The acting director of the IRS.
That's right. President Obama said Secretary Liu requested and then accepted the resignation of the acting IRS commissioner Stephen Miller just today. This happened.
What is it, Nancy, about these 501c4s that makes them so hard for the IRS?
The thing is, it is such a political hot potato, Kai. And the law itself is really unclear. Congress was chicken about it. They didn't spell out the rules of how you can be declared what's called a 501c4. Mm-hmm. And these are nonprofit groups. They're given tax-free status only, though, if their primary purpose is not political. Okay, well, how do you determine that? Do you say, okay, you can be a 501c4 as long as you're not spending, say, more than half your money
on politics?
And some groups have just sort of made it up and said, I've interviewed people about this, and they've said, yeah, well, you know, we just kind of wing it, and we say as long as we're not spending more than half our money on politics, we should qualify.
Yeah.
And the IRS hasn't laid it out either.
To the crisis, or to the scandal, rather, at hand, do we know or have there been any indications that people in the Washington headquarters office were actually involved in making the decisions about which group to investigate and which groups not to investigate?
There have been some reports that they were involved. Apparently, some of the folks in the Cincinnati IRA office, that
IRS,
the Tea Party groups that were being investigated, said, well, these Cincinnati IRS people told us, well, Washington told us to ask you this. It seems hard to believe that there would just be a few rogue IRS officials in Cincinnati who were doing this. But on the other hand, the IRS is designed to be as non-political as possible, right? You know what Nixon did in investigating his enemies using the IRS. So in the wake of that, there are very few political appointees at the IRS.
The scrutiny that these groups got was in the form of bureaucracy, right? Red tape and filling out more applications and having to prove themselves. Has the IRS actually gone anywhere with this? Are they now ceasing to investigate all these groups?
Oh, no. No. I mean, some of them have gotten their tax-free status, but some of them are still waiting. It is a very, very cumbersome process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the IRS says it's understaffed, and then we've got sequestration. So, yes, some of these folks are still waiting, even though the IRS supposedly has shifted its emphasis away from these Tea Party conservative-type groups.
Right. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. There was supposed to be a hearing tomorrow in front of the House Ways and Means Committee about this whole thing. I don't know if that's actually going to happen yet. Nancy,
actually,
thanks a bunch.
Friday.
Oh, Friday now? All right, tomorrow.
Friday.
Yeah. Friday, yeah. There you go. All right, well, moving on. Elsewhere in Washington, there is news of the incredible shrinking budget deficit. According to a new report from the Congressional Budget Office, the deficit this year is going to be way smaller than expected, below $1 trillion for the first time since 2008, which must be good news, don't you think? Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
This news is so big that we took to the streets of Los Angeles to announce it. And a lot of people, like Claire Bennett and Vic Raja, didn't even believe it was possible.
That doesn't really make sense.
I don't even see how that could happen.
But it did happen. The CBO says this year's federal budget deficit will fall to $642 billion. Still a big number, but not even close to the trillion-dollar deficits we have been running. It seems like economists should be really excited about this. But here's Boston University's Lawrence Kotlikoff.
What we're doing is looking at what's happening to a little bush in front of a forest of obligations.
Kotlikoff says the near-term CBO projections look great, but we should be worried about the long-term. As more Americans get older, the cost of health care and Social Security is going to spike, and that will grow the deficit right back. There must be some good news here, right? The deficit shrank for a couple of reasons. People and businesses paid more taxes. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac started paying back dividends. Sequester kicked in. So maybe government policies are working? University of Michigan economist Justin Wolfers.
If what you think the government should be doing is trying to stimulate the economy in a time of mass unemployment, then this is in fact the result of a bad set of policies.
So a shrinking deficit could actually be bad for the economy? I give up. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Speaking of things that are shrinking, we turn now to the European economy. The Eurozone is in the middle of its longest recession since the euro was born more than a decade ago. 9 of the 17 countries that use the single currency are now contracting, and the second largest economy among them, France, is double dipping. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
France has many flaws as an economic power, but Douglas Yates of the American University in Paris says the country's biggest problem right now is geography.
The economy in France is largely dependent on Europe, and with Europe near 0% growth, that affects French exports.
Sales of its cars, chemicals, food, pharmaceuticals and clothing have slumped, especially in its two biggest markets, Spain and Italy. But at least that giant locomotive, Germany, can pull the continent out of the mire. Or can it?
Germany, which is the growth engine, supposedly is just barely crawling out of negative territory. It shrank in the fourth quarter of 2012. It's just growing a little bit now.
Michael Steen of the Financial Times says Europe's sinking under its debt crisis, weighed down by austerity, upset by economic reform. And not only Europe suffers as a result.
Our colleagues in the United States are still deeply concerned about developments in the euro area.
That's the head of Britain's central bank, Mervyn King, who said today the US and Asia are praying for Europe's recovery.
Which, if it were to happen, would go a very long way to help the world economy as a whole.
In other words, France, Spain, Italy and Europe's other troubled economies are not only dragging each other down, they're proving a real drag for the rest of us too. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, just a single dip. Thank you very much. Then traders climbed out of it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Shares of Google topped $900 today, 9:15 and a bit at the close. And there are, of course, a zillion reasons a stock moves one way or the other. One of those reasons for Google today was its big development conference in San Francisco. Thousands of people showed up to find out what's in store. Quite a bit, as it turns out. There's going to be a new music streaming service from Google, some fancy map and photo upgrades as well, and a development that speaks our language. Marketplace's Queen of Kim has that story.
There's a dream techies have been chasing, that one day our computers might sound something like this.
Hello, I am C-3PO, human-cyborg relations, and...
That's C-3PO, and yes, 36 years later, we're still waiting for sci-fi's ultimate personal assistant to become a reality. A computer that talks to you, anticipates your needs, and has a personality.
Really, machines are so unreliable.
Tech companies are in hot pursuit of this dream. There's Apple Siri.
I'm Siri, but enough about me. How can I help you?
Amazon and Microsoft are also moving into voice technology. Your Xbox may be talking to you in the future. And today, at its big developers conference, Google announced that Google Voice is moving beyond phones to desktops and laptops. I recently caught up with Scott Huffman, who leads the Google Voice team.
How far is San Luis Obispo from here? drive from your location to San Luis Obispo is 197.6 miles.
Voice recognition technology, or simply transcribing the phonetics of the spoken word, is commonplace. Call centers use it a lot. But tech companies are racing to actually teach computers to understand language. Remember Huffman's question, how far is San Luis Obispo from here? He says the example shows how steep that learning curve is.
I like this example because of the word here. It's such a simple word, but if you think about it, it actually means a lot of different things.
There's here, as in I can hear you, and then here I am. Getting a computer to understand the way we speak naturally is sort of like teaching it to become human. Huffman says it's a long way off. But he says we're getting close. Computing keeps getting more powerful. Meanwhile, Google has a ton of data on language and knowledge. The next jump is to turn that information into intelligence.
We're moving beyond searches. We traditionally think of it as finding kind of documents to a broader assistant who can find information for you and can do things for you.
In the meantime, there are other economic forces that are bigger than search.
It's about smartphones and tablets and this huge growing list of devices such as smart TVs, our cars, and wearable computers.
Tony Costa is an analyst at Forrester, and he says unlike desktop computers, computers of the future don't really lend themselves to the keyboard and the mouse.
And this really presents a problem for Apple and Google and Microsoft. They're all really struggling to find ways of making this technology very easy and efficient to use.
Michael Chewy researches technology for McKinsey & Company. He says as we hook up everything we do to computers, then the company that masters voice could master, well, almost every part of our lives.
You want to be able to do things naturally in your day-to-day life. So please turn on the TV or raise the temperature.
Are you listening, C3PO? In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up, life after the airwaves.
The difference in the online age is that a show that underperforms on broadcast can actually find like a pretty huge audience online.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained another 60 points today, 0.4%, finished at 15,275, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ edged up 9 points, 0.25%, 3,471 at the bell. The S&P 500 added 8 points, about 0.5%, 1658, the number you're looking for there. Macy's rang up a 2.6% gain today. Deere and Company rolled down 4.4%, though, saying sales won't grow as fast as projected because of bad weather and the slow economic rebound. Pinnacle Foods packed on 5% today. The parent company of Duncan Hines and Aunt Jemima saw a rise in profit and also announced it's going to start paying a quarterly dividend. Apple sliced off 3.3%, continuing its downward trend. Google, meanwhile, scrolled up 3.25% at that conference thing we mentioned. Citigroup and Morgan Stanley each banked a gain of 2.5%. Today, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.94%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on new residential construction for April. A look at what consumers paid for goods and services in April. Was it more or less than in March? The Labor Department releases its monthly consumer price index. And the first Academy Awards ceremony was held on May 16, 1929. The suspense of today's televised events, you know, the Oscar goes to, was not an issue as the winners had already been announced. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know the phrase activist shareholder? Well, if you want to be one, it helps a whole bunch to be really, really rich. Daniel Loeb is both. His hedge fund is called Third Point, and it's bought itself a $1 billion stake in Sony. Loeb is after that company to spin off its movie and music division and focus on reviving its consumer electronics business. But even being Sony's biggest shareholder may not be enough clout. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now on how powerful American investors often get a chilly response in Japan.
American companies are expected to put shareholders first. Japan specialist Arthur Alexander at Georgetown says the Japanese view is different and rooted in history.
The company was seen as a kind of a communal organization that owed its allegiances to its employees, to its customers, to suppliers, to management, not to the shareholder.
Historically, American investors, including the colorful T. Boone Pickens, have found asking for big change provokes a strong reaction. Richard Linnows is an American University management professor.
Shock and fear. But I do think also that there's this recognition that sometimes you need an outsider to bring in another view.
Josh Schechter knows this firsthand. He's a co-president of Steel Partners Japan Asset Management.
It's often difficult for outsiders to come in right off the bat and demand changes to longstanding business practices.
In a previous iteration, Steel Partners lost a six-year battle for change at a Japanese condiment company, Bulldog Sauce. There has also been success. Schechter holds a seat on the board of Adirans, a Japanese wig maker. Ulrika Shada, professor of Japanese business at UC San Diego, says foreign investors can give Japanese managers cover for change.
It is sometimes helpful for management to just say, look, we have a sizable foreign interest and we have no choice.
She and other Japan watchers say Sony is used to hearing foreign perspectives. Remember, until last year, its CEO was a British-born American, and he's still chairman. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
In between all the scandals that Congress is digging into, lawmakers are grinding away at regular business as well. The Senate Agriculture Committee has passed a 10-year, nearly trillion-dollar piece of work known as the Farm Bill. The House took it up today. Tom Vilsack is the Secretary of Agriculture. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you.
First thing I want to know, sir, is why we call the Farm Bill, when it's like 80% food stamps and what is known as domestic food aid?
Well, I refer to it as the Food, Farm, and Jobs Bill because it's all three of those things. It obviously impacts and affects production agriculture, but it also impacts much, much more that occurs in rural America, and it also has an impact on our nutrition assistance programs.
One of the things you're trying to do this year is to increase awareness of organic farming, organic agriculture. You say it's the largest growing section of American agriculture.
Well, it's the fastest growing section. It's not the largest, but it's the fastest growing.
Do you need to tuck another thing into this bill, sir?
Well, I think it's important as we take a look at how we might rebuild the rural economy and revitalize it. We want to make sure that young people have an opportunity to get into the farming business, and that can be expensive unless you start small. Certainly organic provides that high value-added opportunity.
I want to get back to this idea that most of what's in this bill is domestic food aid, food stamps and SNAP, as it's called, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's no small bone of contention in Washington now, this idea of the safety net versus letting people fend for themselves. What do you say to critics who say food stamps and supplemental nutrition is getting too easy to get?
Every dollar that is basically spent and invested in the SNAP program generates $1.84 in economic activity. The key here is not so much to create a process where we are going to disqualify a lot of well-meaning and hard-working folks who just need a little help. The key here is for us to make sure that we have an economy, as the president's working on, that gets better-paying jobs for those folks and thereby reduce the right way the number of people that need this assistance.
With all respect to the members of Congress who work on these issues, it is obviously a very politicized issue. What does it feel like for you to be on the receiving end of that politicking on some of your key programs?
This bill is not just about folks who live, work, and raise their families in rural areas. It's really about the rest of the country as well. And so when they're challenging issues that are presented during the debate, it's an opportunity to educate people.
Tom Vilsack, he's the Secretary of Agriculture. Mr. Secretary, thank you very much for your time.
You bet. Take care.
The news in higher education today comes out of Atlanta. Georgia Tech is going to offer an online master's degree in computer science for just $7,000 all in versus $44,000 for the in-person version. We'll see how that works out, but it is a pretty bold move in the world of MOOCs, as they're known, massive open online courses. And as students are getting used to online learning, so too are instructors, because it's one thing to hold the attention of a bunch of students in a classroom. It's entirely another to hold the attention of thousands of them when you're just an image on a screen. From KQED, Arthi Shahani has the story.
It's day one of Professor Kevin Werbach's class on gamification. Werbach teaches at Penn's Wharton School of Business.
Hi there. I'll be your professor in this course.
Okay, not what I expected. He's an avatar, a little monster with really big elephant feet. And a tent on his back?
Now, don't worry. I'm not actually going to teach the class from inside a video game.
Yeah, he looks like he's teaching from the set of Lord of the Rings.
But I am going to show you how some of the techniques that designers use in games like this one can be applied to problems in business, education, health, and other fields. That's a technique that we call gamification.
With that, the little monster flies away, and the real Professor Werbach reappears in a cozy office with a walnut bookcase.
Much better.
More than 140,000 students have enrolled in Werbach's gamification class. That's rock star status in the MOOC world. But it took more than just a webcam and an internet connection to get him there.
Games are engaging because they are fun. Fun.
Werbach has spent hundreds of hours turning his semester-long course into a simple six-week miniseries. He says he could have written a book in that time. He's replaced hour-long lectures with videos that are 10 minutes max. And to keep students from doing this,
knowing that there are many different things that can produce fun doesn't necessarily tell us.
Werbach throws in an exercise every few minutes to make sure they're paying attention. He's on Twitter, responding to students' gripes about grades. He holds Google Hangouts to check in with his top students around the world.
Radoslav, you had a comment you wanted to follow up on this?
Yeah, I have a thought about this because probably the game evolution will be somehow correlated with gamification.
I met up with the non-virtual Werbach at a conference in San Francisco where he had just wrapped up a keynote address about his MOOC to a packed house.
You have great skin. Do you have a makeup artist?
You're too kind. No, absolutely. No, I grew up in Los Angeles and somehow developed a permanent tan.
Comfortable in front of a webcam and an audience, you can see why he's become a go-to guy for colleagues who are nervous about getting into the online game.
They're worried that they're going to let slip something that's going to offend someone, and if it's just in the classroom with 10 students, it's nothing, but if it's open online, it'll ruin their career. The reality is that rarely happens.
Werbach says MOOCs are great advertising, and not just for him. He has more students online than Wharton has living alumni. And Werbach is willing to bet the MOOC will create brand new customer bases for the education industry. About 3/4 of his students report they are not in school.
They're people, typically professionals, who are taking this for what we would call lifelong learning. So if that ratio is right, that's 500 million people who are not students right now who would be interested and motivated, even at this early stage, in taking one of these courses.
Deirdre Woods directs the Open Learning Initiative at Penn. Woods says schools need to get in the game because MOOCs are part of the future.
You're rowing in the river and you're learning about what's going on, or you're just standing on the banks watching the boat go by.
Woods admits the business model is shaky right now. The professor and university take on extra work for a tiny honorarium. But there's little downside because the crowds come at no cost to the school's reputation. People who ace Werbach's class are Penn fans, not Penn graduates.
These courses are not Penn courses yet. They're intentionally not Penn courses in some ways because of the experimental nature of them.
For now, the MOOC is a way for accomplished professors to explore new frontiers, and their universities get to come along for the ride. In San Francisco, I'm Arthi Shahani for Marketplace.
For all you Dunder Mifflin fans out there, tomorrow night is it your last chance to see Dwight, Angela, Jim, and the rest of them from The Office, or at least to see him during primetime on NBC. The show is already syndicated on TBS and Fox, but where does a beloved broadcast sitcom go nowadays once it's been put out to pasture? Sally Herships has this one.
The internet. Now you can watch TV anytime, almost anywhere, which means bazillions of dollars for content providers, right? Just listen to Michael Scott, the boss on The Office.
When I discovered YouTube, I didn't work for 5 days. I did nothing.
But to appreciate The Office, you have to know its storyline and characters, like Dwight's beet farm or Angela's obsession with cats. Paige Albianak is an editor with Cable and Broadcasting Magazine. She says the inside jokes make it hard for casual viewers to tune into just one episode.
Let's switch over to The Big Bang Theory, which does incredibly well in syndication. That show is not nearly as available online.
Albianak says you won't find The Big Bang Theory on Netflix or on Amazon because the cable networks and local TV stations that pay, likely upwards of $2 million an episode, expect a lot of bang for their buck.
The more they pay for it, the more exclusivity they get.
But for shows with lower ratings, like NBC's The Office or 30 Rock, there can still be life and profit after the TV screen goes dark.
The difference in the online age is that a show that underperforms on broadcast can actually find like a pretty huge audience online.
Jethro Netadog is with Hollywood website The Wrap. He says even if a show's audience is smaller, when it's online, advertisers know viewers watch episodes over and over and over again. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which qualifies, I do believe, for the This Week Sign the Apocalypse is Upon Us tag. Angry Birds, the movie, is coming soon to a theater near you. Sony Pictures Entertainment and Rovio are going to team up for a full-length animated 3D version of that game for the big screen, which does kind of make you think back to Mark Garrison's story. Doesn't it? About getting Sony to concentrate more on consumer electronics and maybe not so much on the movies? Yeah? All right. We're done. That's it. That's Marketplace from, I play Angry Birds, but still, the movie? APM is the name of this company. Today, the Dow gained another 60 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ edged up 9 points, 0.25%. I don't play a lot, just every now and then. The S&P 500 added 8 points, about 0.5%. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. They probably play too, I don't know. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.